Hello there. Welcome to the Frenchie Podcast, a show dedicated to the stories and legacy of the French-speaking Cajuns of World War II, as told by the veterans themselves. I'm your host, Jason Terrio. For over 20 years, I've been interviewing World War II veterans, capturing their stories. Many of them were Cajuns, people of Acadian descent. When the young Cajuns went overseas, their ability to speak French proved invaluable to military operations, and it had a profound impact on their sense of Acadian identity. What emerged from this unique wartime experience was a long-lost pride in their heritage. When the military needed bilingual interpreters, they called on Frenchie to bridge the language gap. This June marks the 80th anniversary of D-Day. I recently had the privilege of driving around Cajun country with a French TV reporter named Fanny Allard, who contacted me about doing a feature story on the Frenchies for this historic anniversary event in France. We interviewed the last three living Frenchies from World War II, Norris Morvant, Shirley Guidry, and Pridgen Fontenot. I was fortunate to find and interview these veterans a few years ago, and their stories will be told in the upcoming book, Frenchie, the Story of the French-Speaking Cajuns of World War II, which will be published by UL Press and released in late summer of 2024. Stay tuned for a special pre-order announcement at the end of this program. And be sure to check out Fanny's TV special that is set to air on France 24 TV for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. It is estimated that perhaps several hundred Cajuns from Louisiana participated in the Normandy invasion. We know of at least one Cajun GI who was killed on Omaha Beach on the first wave on June 6, 1944. He was Private Houston Duyon, a native of New Iberia. His best friend in the Army, Carol Medier, a Cajun from nearby Lorville, jumped off the Higgins boat right next to him. Within an instant, Houston was mortally wounded by German machine gun fire. Carol survived the battle and lived to tell the story of that event on bloody Omaha Beach and about his journey across his ancestral homeland as a French-speaking Cajun. He related this personal story during a telephone interview many years ago.
Carol Medier in Lorville, Louisiana. I just got through washing the dishes.
Metier, Mr. Carol, are your ancestors from Acadia or from France?
I really believe France, because right after the war, but the war wasn't quite through yet, when I bumped into an old man in Versailles, France, where the armistice was signed in 1918. They walked into a barbershop there, and it was about five blocks from where I was. Went in the evening, got me a haircut, and I walked in there, and it was a two-chair barbershop. And so I looked at the bench over there. There was an elderly man sitting down. So I joined him. We got to talking in French, but my French wasn't that good to parlay with these old dudes. But anyway, he asked me where I was from and what's my name. And so after a while, I said, "Well, sir, what is your name?" He said, "My name is Raoul Metier, and my dad's name was Raoul Metier." Identically sounding, identically spelled. And the old man was 74 years old. You see, I was only 19 then. So when you're only 18 or 19 and you meet up with somebody 60 or 70, they're old. But not so today when you reach that old, that age. So we continued talking, and he explained to me that he'd been living there all his life. And he had a son and daughter in 1939 when the Germans took over France. They picked up his son and daughter and sent them to Germany on a workforce. And here was almost 1945, and he still hadn't heard from him. He said, "Well, I can't believe your name is Carol Metier." I said, "Yes, sir, my name is Carol Metier."
Carol grew up in the country as one of 12 kids. His father ran a bakery. Like so many others, Carol grew up speaking French and learned English at school later on. At 18 years old, he was bagging groceries at a local grocery store owned by a Mr. Braquet. He joined the Army to serve in World War II, and his world soon changed.
And then I just made 18, about the war then, They had sent me the papers for me to come and sign up, and Mr. Louis Braque, I was working there for the steady. He said, oh, I can get you a deferment or some kind, he says. I said, no, Mr. Louis, I says, I'm going to war. I told him that just like that.
Huh.
And I went to war. So I got come to New Iberia and signed up, and in a week's time, I was in Camp Pork in Alexandria area. I went there for about a week or 10 days, and they shipped us out from there to Fort Sheridan, Illinois. We knew that we were three or four from Louisiana there at that time, taking my basic training. And we knew those people that kind of looked down at us, you see. They call us web feet and crap like that. Alligator fighters and crap like that. What could you do? They tell you that? And we tell them something else, that you're from Texas, Texas bullshitters or something like that. But I became a good friends with a young man from the Bronx, New York. He didn't look down at me at all. But he wanted to learn about Louisiana and my French, and I'd teach him a little French, and he was a good friend. He became a good friend, and Houston Dio and I, George from Hayes, Louisiana, we were all in the same platoon in the same company. Houston Dio and I, we were close friends. I knew that I didn't know anything before when I first got into the service. I did just a dumb coon ass from Louisville. And I'd never been anywhere, really. I'd been to New Iberia only. And I saw how greatly that changed me. I went into the world. You could say I went into another world. But we didn't have nothing here in Louisville. I mean, nothing, you hear me? We just barely survived, because my daddy had a little job making bread. He'd bring three breads home every morning. Breads were a nickel apiece. And that really changed me. I went into the world, and I couldn't believe what I would see there, away from Louisville. So much bigger and better things. The further north we went, the bigger it got. Listen, when you're 18 years old, 18, 19, you don't worry too much about if you're going to be 80 years old or not. You know, it uh-huh. doesn't come to your mind at all. I can't remember that being in my mind, that I was fighting for my country. We knew that, all right, see. But you never worried about it, really. But then the next step was when we hit the beach, getting out of the Higgins boat, and that was the closest to ever dying, I guess. And when he got hit, he just slumped on me. I saw the blood on his back of his head. Oh, God, and I started hollering. And somebody there helped me drag him. We got out in the water 3 feet deep. We finally got him ashore, and then I continued. I couldn't stay there. I had to keep going. They were strafing the hell out of us with machine guns. And I had to run about 30 or 40 feet, and I'd fall flat on my stomach, and I'd look around, and I'd see bodies flying through the air and stuff like that. I said, well, I'll be a son of a bitch. What am I doing here? On the morning of that climbing on that beach there, I remember laying on my stomach there between spurts of running. I remember saying, I can't believe, Carol, what the hell are you doing out here? Just like that, I said it out loud. And the mines were going up, the soldiers were stepping on these landmines and blowing themselves up. And I didn't know when mine was going to get there.
20 years ago, I had the honor of attending the 60th anniversary of D-Day in Normandy with the Stephen Ambrose Historical Tour Company. It's a remarkable set of circumstances that brought me to that sacred place. And for those of you who have visited Normandy, you know it's a trip of a lifetime. So here's how it happened. About a year prior to the June 2004 D-Day anniversary, a fellow historian friend of mine, Shane Bernard, and I came up with an idea to honor Houston Dujon in some special way. We plan to have a wreath laid at his grave at the American Cemetery overlooking Omaha Beach, and to have him honored with a state legislative resolution to be presented to his family in New Iberia on June 6, 2004. Well, that proved to be a tall order. We pulled some strings and, with help from then State Senator Craig Romero, got the concurrent resolution drafted, signed, framed, and delivered in time for this momentous event. But to get a wreath laid at his graveside in France required more than just a few timely phone calls and favors. Somebody had to go. That someone was me. So I called Yeager Katz, the president of the Stephen Ambrose Historical Tour Company, and asked if they had any spots available for the 60th anniversary trip. He put me in touch with a D-Day veteran named Al Spoonheimer, who was an Army medic in the war and was going over with his group of veterans from his unit, the 197th Anti-Aircraft Battalion. I called this old veteran and told him the story of Houston Duyon, and he said there was one spot left on the bus with his group, mostly veterans and their families from the 197th. The 197th, I thought. That's interesting, because Duyon and Metier were in the 397th Anti-Aircraft Unit. Could there be some relationship between the two units? I wondered. When I asked Spoonheimer about this, he got choked up on the phone and had to call me back a few minutes later. Come to find out, those two units landed side by side at Easy Red Sector on Omaha Beach on the first wave. Being a medic, Spoonheimer treated several GIs from the 397th, who were all part of a separate 50 caliber machine gun squads, like Duyon and Metier were. Spoony, as he was called, was assigned to lead the temporary grave detail on the beach for those first few days and weeks. It's highly possible that Spoony was the last to see Houston Duyon. "Jason, you're coming with us, and we're going to find Duyon's grave," he told me over the phone. Several months later, I wound up on a tour bus with him, several dozen other eager tourists, a top-notch bus driver, and our tour guide, the noted military historian, Ron Drez. We were headed for France. On the afternoon of June 6, following the day's events with speeches from dignitaries in front of thousands of onlookers, we found Houston Duyon's grave and held a brief wreath-laying ceremony to honor his sacrifice. Halfway around the world, in the New Iberia town square, a group led by Senator Romero, Shane Bernard, and then-president of CODAFIL, Warren Perrin, presented a frame resolution to Duyon's surviving sister, with Carol Metier by her side. That evening, from a hotel balcony in Paris, I placed a long-distance call to radio host Jeff Boggs of Kane Radio, 1240 AM in New Iberia, for this live interview.
And actually, I wanted to get to another caller because, one, he's calling from long distance, and, two, I wanted to make sure we had plenty of opportunity to talk to Jason Terrio, a local author who is or was in Normandy, France yesterday for the D-Day celebration. And, Jason, you're not only here on Kane, but, of course, you're also with our sister stations, KLRZ and KLEB. Thanks so much for giving us a call.
Bonjour, Monsieur Boggs.
Bonjour, indeed. First of all, tell us, for our new listeners in La Rose, in the home of Thibodeau area, what was the purpose of your visit to Normandy?
Jeff, thank you for having me on. I'm staring, looking out of my window here at the Holiday Inn Hotel in downtown Paris. It's absolutely beautiful, breathtaking. I'm in Paris here after several days of traveling with a group from the Stephen Ambrose Historical Tours out of New Orleans. And the purpose of our trip, obviously, was to go and commemorate and to celebrate and to salute the men who landed at Normandy beaches on June 6, 1944, just short of 60 years ago yesterday. And there's a gentleman, a young man, an Iberian, a Cajun soldier, named Private First Class Houston D. Duyon, who was killed at Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. He's buried right there at St. Laurent, France, and had a wonderful opportunity to see his gravesite. But more importantly, Jeff, and more fitting, I guess, is the word to say, the group that I'm traveling with was with the 197th Anti-Aircraft Battalion, and Houston Duyon's unit was the 397th mm-hmm. Anti-Aircraft Battalion. Those two units landed at Easy Red Section on Omaha Beach at 7 a.m. on June 6th, side by side. They landed within a few kilometers of each other, and the resident expert on Omaha Beach who's traveling with us, his name is Albert Spoonheimer. We refer to him as Spoonie. He won't be called by anything else.
Okay.
Wonderful guy. He's been telling stories nonstop ever since we've left from London a few days ago. Spoonie was the head medic on that particular sector. And when and as I told you and your listeners a week ago today, Jeff, when Houston Duyon jumped off of the Higgins boat right next to Carol Medier from Lorville, the two Cajun soldiers with the 397th, Houston was struck by enemy fire, by a bullet in the neck, and he fell over, and more than likely he was probably killed instantly. But undoubtedly, there's a very good chance that Mr. Albert Spoonheimer, Spoonie as we refer to him, was the head medic on that section, and he more than likely probably saw Houston Duyon. And yesterday on MSNBC, Spoonie was on camera giving an interview with a reporter. And this is what I didn't know until he said this yesterday, that most of his unit, this is Albert Spoonheimer, the 197th, most of his unit made it through without any heavy casualties. But he says on camera that the 397th suffered 80% casualties within the first 20 minutes.
Wow.
And those were the guys that he was treating.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the guys who died in his arms.
No doubt. Compelling stuff. I can't even imagine the experience there, just being there for the Normandy experience. Tell me, did the death or word of the death of President Reagan, how did that affect the ceremonies?
It was somewhat chilling, Jeff. We didn't find out until we got on our bus, on our tour bus, on June 6th, the early morning of June 6th. And it brought a somber tone to the, you know, to the excitement and the anticipation of what was getting ready to happen. We were going down to the St. Lawrence Cemetery, the main cemetery up there at Omaha Beach, where there's 9,000 soldiers, American soldiers, who were killed on D-Day and within a few days of that historical event. And I tell you what, I was maybe just a little too young to remember President Reagan's speech about the boys from Point du Hoc, but Captain Ron Drez, who was our tour guide, says that that particular speech that Reagan gave, and I want to say during the 40th anniversary of D-Day, about the boys from Point du Hoc, that particular speech is what really began the awareness across the nation about the D-Day events and about the heroes who made the invasion, those who survived, and, of course, those who paid the ultimate sacrifice. And during that 40th anniversary up until now, we can look at some at President Reagan's speech, former President Reagan's speech, as maybe the defining moment of the beginnings of what we know as the celebration of the D-Day soldiers and the awareness and the collecting of beginning of the collecting of oral histories of those men who landed at D-Day, June 6th.
Okay, well, I definitely appreciate you giving us a call. I know was not easy necessarily making sure you would be at a phone while we were on the air, but I appreciate you making the extra effort. And again, we want to remind folks that Jason has written a couple of books on Bayou Veterans of World War II, and we look forward to the third. And I know you've got a couple of local appearances coming up. Do you know them offhand?
Yeah, Jeff. Before I even speak about that, let me just, while I've got just a few more minutes here, I just arrived at this hotel here about an hour ago.
Okay.
Jeff, if you wouldn't mind.
Please, go ahead.
When I found Private First Class Houston Dion's grave site, of course I was completely taken aback by emotions that I can't explain to you over the air. It's an unbelievable sight to see those 9,000 marble grave tombs. It's really unbelievable. And when I spoke to you a week ago, Jeff, I was a very proud American, a patriot. I'm very proud to be doing what I'm doing and thankful for those veterans. But when I walk through those rows and those grave sites and I see the price of freedom, the sacrifice of freedom, it gives me a completely and totally different perspective on life and on freedom and on democracy and on how important it is that we preserve these stories and honor these men at every given moment.
No doubt.
There were literally thousands of D-Day veterans there, Jeff, and as I kneeled down at Houston Dunal's gravesite, ironically, and I guess maybe the word is fittingly, off to my right, about 50 yards away, Albert Spoonheimer, the head medic of the 197th, who was there on Easy Red, is sitting in a chair next to Captain Ron Drez, and they're live on Fox News, giving an interview. And in the background, I'm standing there next to this man's gravesite. Once the interview was done, Captain Drez and Albert Spoonheimer, Spoonie we'll call him, he and I and Captain Drez, we walked over to Houston's gravesite. There was a roof that was laid just a few yards away, and we found three young 18-year-old United States Army soldiers who were there just to pay their respects. And the group of us went, and we had a brief little ceremony at Houston's gravesite. And it was unbelievable. Unbelievable, Jeff. It really was.
Jason, I appreciate you sharing these stories with us. We'll look forward to getting you back on again sometime when you get back here in the States.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me on. Hello to everybody in Acadiana, and you folks take care.
Take care, sir.
Thank you, Jeff.
Jason Theriault, as he calls us live from Paris, France, having just been in Normandy for the 60th anniversary of D-Day. Compelling stuff indeed.
Finding Dunal's grave was a collaborative effort, thanks in large part to my friend Shane Bernard. I've asked Shane, who's been the archivist at the McElhinney Company for 31 years, to come on this program and share his memories of that event. Welcome to the program, Shane. It's hard to believe that was 20 years ago.
Thanks for having me on your show, Jason. Yeah, it was 20 years ago that you and I got together to help honor a Cajun GI who died on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. And I think since then we've found out he wasn't the only one who was killed in action during the D-Day landings. But the one that you and I helped to commemorate, his name was Houston Dunal. And the way I found out about him was kind of odd. I moved from Texas, from Bryan College Station, Texas, where I was studying for my PhD at Texas A&M University, to New Iberia to be near my workplace. And this was the late 1990s. And next to my house was an old wood frame house similar to my own that was being fixed up. And I went inside, and on the floor was what looked like a Life magazine. It was the same size, the same thickness, same dimensions, glossy paper. But when I picked it up, I found it was a list of I won't say all, but a great many soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen from Iberia Parish who had served in World War II. And almost every entry had a little black and white photo of the service personnel, both men and women. And one of the things I noticed was that there was an entry for someone named Houston Dunal, who died on June 6th, 1944. And I don't remember if the entry for Dunal expressly said he was killed in action on the beaches of Normandy, or if I just assumed that from the date. But I began doing some research about Houston Dunal, and I found, you know, what part of town he had lived in before going off in the military. And I also found he was buried at a cemetery in France, or maybe it was you who figured that out. And it just so happened that you were going to be in France on a World War II themed tour that year. This would have been, 2004. And you and I came up with the idea of honoring Houston Dunal, Private Houston Dunal. I would be doing so in New Iberia, Louisiana, and you would be doing so on the beaches of Normandy or in the American cemetery near those beaches. And that's what happened. And the event in New Iberia was held right outside of City Hall, next to the main location of our public library. And you and I had managed to track down some of Houston Dunant's descendants, of which there were quite a few. And these would have been great nephews and great nieces, I believe. You and I convinced Senator Craig Romero in the state legislature to pass a concurrent resolution honoring Houston Dunant for his sacrifice. And so we were able to present with Senator Romero, who was there at City Hall, present those descendants of Houston Dunant with an official state resolution framed for them to take home with them. And meanwhile, you were in the American cemetery, or one of the American cemeteries at Normandy, commemorating Houston Dunant there at his actual gravesite. You asked how World War II influenced the Cajun people. So I argue in my book, The Cajuns' Americanization of a People, that it was World War II that really sparked the Americanization of the Cajuns for the first time on a rapid, widespread basis. It's interesting, Jason, that Cajuns who were able to use their French-speaking skills overseas, whether in France or French colonies in North Africa or French possessions in the Asia-Pacific area, were able to sense a sort of self-worth, a sort of ethnic pride that many other Cajuns would not experience until later, until the 1960s, when you had the birth of the Cajun ethnic pride movement. You even see this pride reflected on nose art on aircraft. I mean, I have three photographs of three different World War II airplanes in various theaters of the war with the word Cajun painted on the fuselage. And this is in an era in which Cajun pride supposedly didn't exist yet. And this really ties into your book, Frenchie, that's coming out shortly. Because having read an advanced version of the manuscript, I know in that book you discuss this at length, how World War II service for French-speaking Cajuns, especially among those who actually used French in the field when fighting the Axis powers, led them to really embrace a self-worth and an ethnic pride that was unusual for the time. Incidentally, I want to congratulate you on the publication of your book, Frenchie. As I mentioned, I've read an advanced copy of it, and I think it's going to be an excellent addition to the field of Cajun and Creole studies, and I'm looking forward to it coming out shortly.
Thanks, Shane, for your contributions to Cajun heritage and to this decades-long project. There are so many memories from that pilgrimage to France surrounding the 60th anniversary of D-Day event to find Dunant's grave. So many historic sites, monuments visited, emotional speeches heard, and testimonials given from veterans and their families, and even local people who were so thankful for the return of these American liberators 60 years later. It was indeed a trip of a lifetime. A year later, I published Volume 3 of the To Honor Our Veterans trilogy, the last of that World War II book series, where I try to capture some of those experiences, walking in the shadows of those who liberated Europe like Carol Metier, and following the battlefields from D-Day to the Rhine. One of the many memorable moments came in the little town of Boursy, Belgium, where Al Spoonheimer's unit set up a defensive perimeter during the Battle of the Bulge. The townspeople held a special welcome for these returning veterans, and our tour group got to tag along. 100 or so people from this small village all gathered at a local school, and with American flags waving, a few dozen school kids sang this lovely song as a thank you to their liberators who had returned 60 years later.
blessing of going through all of that and come back home, being able to work for a living, support your families, mm-hmm. work for companies, and thank God for that we pulled through it. I always wonder why I'm still alive. I almost got killed after the beach on the, I almost got killed there on the Battle of the Bulge. Some narrow escapes there too. And I always wonder why did I survive and all the rest of them poor suckers got killed. You know, that's how war is. Some do and some don't. And I was one of them that just survived.
This June, the free world again turns its attention to the beaches of Normandy to honor the sacrifices of so many and to pay tribute to the last of that great World War II generation. I asked Fanny Aller to come on this program to talk about her experience interviewing the last of the Frenchies from South Louisiana for her special program to air on the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Welcome, Fanny.
Hi, Jason. Thank you so much for inviting me to your Frenchie podcast. And thank you especially for taking me to French Cajun country to introduce me to the last of the Frenchies, the last of the veterans of World War II still alive in Louisiana. There are only three of them. I've been able to meet with all of them because you introduced me. So I feel very, very privileged. That was an amazing experience, being able to meet with the men who liberated Europe, who helped us, you know, free ourselves from the Nazis is something that I will remember for the rest of my life. And I value their testimony so much. I think we have a duty to keep sharing their stories, to make sure that the next generation remembers and to make sure that we don't repeat the same mistakes. We tend to think that freedom is granted, but it's not. And recently, we've seen that, you know, things can change very fast, as we've seen in Eastern Europe, for example. But anyway, as a French reporter in the U.S., I've been very attracted to Louisiana since I arrived 6 years ago. And actually, the first time I went was 4 years ago. And it really moves me to meet with people who value their heritage, who speak French, because language is such a big part of anyone's identity, really, and the fact that it can link people and link the diaspora of French people all over the world is something that I find amazing. And I also love the pride that people have today in their French heritage in Louisiana, and also because it's not always been this way, and I was very happy to hear it from the people who lived it. Norris Morvan, whom you've introduced me to, told me all about how French was forbidden when he was in school, but that's the only language he knew how to speak back then, and the language he would speak with his parents and his siblings. And actually, the first time I heard about the Frenchies was when I went to Louisiana 4 years ago, and I was interviewing an old man, not old enough to have been drafted himself, but he was telling me about his older brothers who went to France and came back proud of who they were. And when I was with you in Louisiana a few weeks back, you know, it all made sense because I met with the people who lived it. And again, I feel very privileged. These men have so much humility, and yet, you know, they've freed us from the worst. So that was amazing. I spent 3 hours with Norris, and I actually made a 6-minute story just about himself, a portrait, as we would call it in television, and it's going to air next week. It's going to air on Tuesday. So I invite you all to tune in on France 24 or on YouTube. We air in four languages, Arabic, Spanish, French, and English. So to all of the non-French speaking people listening, you can find the English version of what I did in French. Norris is actually talking to me in French, so it's going to be subtitled for the English version. Although he switched to English at the end because I think it was challenging for him, not speaking French every day as he used to. But yeah, I mean, Louisiana has a special place in my heart, and the story of these men who were shamed because they were different and they had their own ways and went to Europe to fight for their country, the USA, and came back as American heroes, but also proud of their Cajun French identity, something that I find amazing. And a story that is not well known but needs to be told. And Jason, you've done such an amazing work. You have your book coming up, and I hope a lot of people buy it and read these stories that are very special. I always call Louisiana a small part of France lost in the USA, and actually I like to tell that the people I meet there always tell me, no, we're not from America, we're not Americans, we're from Louisiana, which is very different. I invite you all to tune in, and I give a big shout out to all the French speakers out there who fight for their culture and their heritage. It's very important. That's all that we have. So thank you again, and stay tuned for the commemoration of June 6th and all that's gonna come next. Bye bye.
Thank you, Fanny. And thank you for capturing the stories of these Cajun Frenchies on film for the great people of Louisiana, especially on this historic anniversary when we are entering a critical juncture in time when the last of the veterans who liberated Europe from Nazi fascists fade into history. Let their service and sacrifice be a reminder for us to stay vigilant about the threats to freedom that lurk from within and abroad. We'll give the last word to Carole Metayer, who passed away in 2007.
Even today, I was glad that I could speak a little French with those people. And everyone I would talk to in French over there, they say, I can't believe you're from Louisiana. I said, yeah, I'm from Louisiana. And they want to know how much talking we had. I said, we had plenty when I had talking. It was two different kind of French, you understand? Spoke that real French. And I bumped into some right quick after the Normandy invasion. I went through them hills and I run into them, and they tell me stories about how the Germans had taken over in 1939, and the Germans would take all that butter, that milk from their cows, and the Germans would steal all their wines. The French was a wine-growing people, you know. They'd store wine in their cellars, and the Germans would come there and take all that stuff away from them. Yeah, I was called upon when I got to Versailles. Our company commander wanted me to go to that capital there, that big building where all the staffs were. Wanted me to go in there and talk to the mayor. I said, I can't do that. He said, oh, yes, you can. He said, we'll bring men out there with you. So he sent three men out there with me. We got to talk, finally got the mayor in the office, and I asked him what I wanted. We wanted to get some anti-aircraft artillery guns on the edge of the cemetery, a good approach when the airplane would come and bomb that rail yard. This was still in 1944. So I spoke to that mayor. He said, where you from, son? He asked me in French. He said, well, je viens de la Loroville, de la Louisiane, de la Loroville. He said, mais je peux pas croire. I said, mais tu peux pas croire. So we talked a little more. He was a busy man. And he said, yeah, tu peux mettre an artillery piece in French is DCA contre avion, a gun against airplanes. He said, yeah, you can put your guns there, I don't remember exactly his words, but he didn't want us to destroy the area. I said, mister, the only time we'll destroy if the Germans come and bomb us. then we'll destroy it. But he says, I said, I'll see that we don't destroy it by throwing a trash around and stuff like that. He's fine. I'm all right. Yeah, boom. So I spoke to him for about 15 or 20 minutes at most. He was glad to talk with me. But I said, listen, I can't talk to your good friend like you, but I can understand you a little bit. He's fine. I'm all right. Yeah, boom.
This concludes this episode of the Frenchy Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Terrio. I'm pleased to announce that the long-awaited publication of the Frenchy book is set for August 2024. UL Press has created a pre-order form, the link to which can be found on my website at jasonterrio.com under the Frenchy Podcast tab on the main menu. And don't forget to search for the Frenchy Special, produced by Fanny Allard on France 24 TV. Music for this show is provided by Josh Caffrey and Chris Segura from the Center for Louisiana Studies.